Welcome to this edition of The B Word, the show where we demystify everything to do with B2B branding, what it really is, how it works, and why it matters. My name is John Galpin, co-founder of branding agency Designed by Structure, and your host for today's episode. And joining me today is Jatin Ondia, CEO and co-founder of Shojin Property Partners. Welcome, Jatin.
Hello, thank you.
So let's talk about Shojin. So Shojin is a property investment platform sharing opportunities with investors all over the world, in UK property predominantly right now.
The idea very simply being enabling people all over the world to invest on a fractional basis. And most importantly, actually, to invest into real estate development. So, you know, in the past, when people thought about investing in property, they thought about a buy-to-let. And that's fine, but obviously buy-to-let's been completely killed off by the government. But the opportunity is still in the development space. You know, we have a massive shortage of housing in the UK. There's not enough funding. So really, we're addressing the funding gap for developing mid-size projects, and we're opening that up to a global network of investors.
And just give us a feel, Jatin, if you can, for some of the projects that your investors have and yourselves have funded together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, things like office to residential conversion. So some great ones right now, you know, are in Slough and Reading, both a few minutes walk from the Elizabeth line. Both office blocks were quite modern. They were only about 18 years old and both being converted to over 100 apartments each. The idea being potentially to sell to kind of end buyers, but actually I think the more interesting part is keeping hold of them as what they call build to rent or pure rental blocks. And really, that's where I see the future. You know, the UK is so far behind on the rental model. You know, we've always had this thing with property, this obsession that we've got to own it. But in reality, you know, your needs change throughout your life. You know, from when you graduate, you're happy to be in a room, you know, a shared apartment or a studio. You then move to a one bed. Maybe you get a partner, you move to a two. But then, you know, it changes. You know, you have kids and so on. And in reality, property should be like anything, you know, a bit like how people lease their car for 3 years at a time. It should be a bit more like that, where you're constantly moving to address what you need at that time. And also, you know, with global social mobility now, it's a strong chance, you know, especially for young people, they're not even going to be where they are now in a few years' time. They'll be moving around the country and around the world. So the rental model really needs to pick up pace.
And it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because I mean, the US has a pretty well-established build-to-rent sector, actually. And funny enough, we just did a job for a company in Denver that was building a whole range of tools for the developers of these kind of build-to-rent opportunities to kind of help them lease the actual units kind of faster. And that feels like a very developed market relative to kind of what we have here in the UK right now.
Definitely. I mean, I lived in New York for a few years, and we lived in one of those rental buildings. And this was now 15 years ago. It was miles ahead. The quality was top notch. You know, one of the biggest problems here is you have all these small landlords, and so the quality is not managed to the same level. You know, if you need a repair done, it takes you 3 weeks to get a repair. Whereas over there, literally you call the front desk and they send someone up within 20 minutes. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And now, you know, and again, the US are always ahead in this stuff. With the application of technology, it gets even better, right? You know, you can do everything through an app. You can create communities. You know, the rental model has changed massively. The US is definitely way ahead, but the UK needs to get there.
Let's rewind slightly and talk about what led you to co-founding Shojin back in 2009. What was the kind of gap or the opportunity that you saw, Jatin?
Yeah, so actually, it's like with a lot of these things, they just evolve over time. And in my case, you know, I was always invested in real estate. It's a very Indian mentality. You know, since you're little, you're taught always invest in real estate. And so when you start working, you know, instead of going out and buying flashy clothes and flashy cars, you buy property. And it was great advice, obviously, from the parents, because over a number of years, I started building a great portfolio. And a lot of people I was working with were really intrigued by what I was doing. Now, I'm talking smart people in banking circles. And, you know, a lot of them were asking how I was doing this. And, you know, even when I'd explain, you realize that they don't have the time or inclination to do this themselves. I mean, buy to let isn't rocket science, but you know, bankers are busy. And then you kind of look further, you know, doctors, lawyers, accountants, all professionals, everyone's busy. So a lot of people just don't bother doing it themselves, but they know they should. They know they want to, because real estate throughout history has been the place where people build and preserve wealth. No matter where you make your money, sooner or later you end up in real estate. So a lot of people started asking if they could simply invest with us. And that's how we started Shogen. And, you know, it was that kind of aha moment, like, hey, there's a business opportunity here. So my co-founder was a good friend of mine. He comes from a construction background. But initially, you know, all we were doing was buying high yielding properties, student properties mostly. But that then evolved into doing renovation projects, that evolved into doing construction projects. But then we hit upon the actual big idea that we have today, because there were two massive gaps in the market. The first thing was developers weren't getting funding. So, you know, small developers, you know, they can borrow money from friends and family, but as they start doing larger projects, there's no funding available. You know, it's like in business circles, you know, the funding gap they always talk about. So we found that projects between 10 and 60 million pounds were just not getting funded. So as a result of that, for those that did manage to fund them, the profit margins were bigger. So we said to these developers, we said, look, why don't you show us your project and we'll analyze it. If it meets all of our criteria, what we'll do is we'll provide the funding and then we'll invite all our investors to come on board. And that just took off because it was such a massive gap in the market. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing was, you know, because the returns we were generating were brilliant. I mean, you know, we were getting 20 to 35% per annum. Before we take our share, we keep about 25, 30%. The rest goes to investors. But even then, you know, investors are getting 15 to 25%, let's say. You know, it's a great return.
It's a great return.
And, you know, there's very few things that will give you that kind of return without huge risk. And in this, there's risk, but it's not crazy. It's just inefficient as a market. So that's when we realized that actually there's people all over the world that would love this. And we did our research and found that there are 600 million mass affluent investors. And what I mean by that is you've got the wealthy family offices, you have tens of millions, hundreds of millions. But then you've got professionals, people who've made money, anything, you know, from a few hundred thousand to a few million pounds of investable funds. So they're not loaded, they're not mega rich, they don't have a family office. And they want to invest in this space. And, you know, at the time, the crowdfunding model was taking off. And we realized we couldn't do it in the traditional crowdfunding way, because if you did this at £50 a pot, you'd be there forever trying to raise the money. So really, the market that was untapped and ripe for us was that, again, the middle market, the mass affluent. So we became FCA regulated and launched this as a digital platform. Mm-hmm. So that we could have that global reach and have the technology do the heavy lifting with, you know, processing investors at 5, 10, 20,000 a pop. And that's really what led us to where we are today. So today we have investors in over 50 countries. We have investors putting in, you know, 5, 10, 20,000. We have investors putting in 100, 200,000. And we have family offices coming on board, putting in, you know, between 1 and 3 million per transaction. And that means that we're on the right path. We're truly opening up this market. We're not disrupting a market because it just didn't exist before. You know, there was no one funding these projects. So it's almost like we've created this new market. People are getting a great return on their money. Developers are getting the funding they need. They're building homes. We're building the homes that we need in the UK. So it all comes together, really.
And there's a few things that are quite different in the way that you've gone about this as well that are probably worth talking about now, right? In terms of your kind of shared investing or shared opportunity approach that you kind of take with these projects. I think that seems like quite something that's quite different relative to kind of how some others in the market have approached, you know, similar opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you take traditional crowdfunding, right, the way it worked was A, needed money, B, has money, you provide the platform, get a transaction done. And then the platform just takes a fee. The problem there is no one's looking after the investor's interest. And if you think about it, when an investor invests into a real estate development project, they don't really understand the risks end to end, right? So someone's got to be there to do that assessment, to look after the investor's interest, to monitor the project. And that's where we saw the difference coming in. You know, the way we do it is we're not just a platform providing funding. Actually, we're a partner in the process. You know, we for many years actually we've been co-investing. We monitor the project from start to end. We also, you know, the bulk of the money we make is at the end. In fact, initially we didn't make any money until the end. Then we realized that was a bit silly, actually, because someone's going to keep the lights on. You know, you can't pay your staff. How are you going to monitor the project?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the fee model changed slightly, but still the bulk of the money we make comes at the end when investors get paid. And so when you put all of these things together, it's very much an aligned model. You know, if the investor wins, we win. And if the investor doesn't win, we definitely don't win. You know, it's structured that way.
And also as well that you're kind of curating quite carefully the actual investments that go on your platform. So in the example that you just gave where, you know, anyone could list a development, you know, say on a crowdfunding platform, that is not the case with Shojin in the sense of, you know, the due diligence and stuff that you guys will do on every project. Probably worth touching on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we would never let a developer just come and list something on the platform. And that's a recipe for disaster. Developers are lovely people, but they're optimists by nature, as are most business owners, let's be honest, right? You have to be. But the fact is that someone's got to scrutinize the numbers. Someone's got to, you know, apply some reality to it. You know, someone's got to do the sensitivity analysis on it. You know, what if the market does drop? You know, what if rates do go up more? So that's really our job. You know, we go through very, very, very detailed due diligence. And, you know, we reject the majority of projects that come in. I mean, the beauty of being in our space is because there's not that much competition, we get to see most of the deal flow. And then we get to cherry pick the best deals. And it's, you know, we unashamedly do that, you know, because we're looking for the projects that have great returns, but as low risk as possible. Yeah. And, you know, if there's two projects, same return, but one has lower risk, well, we're going for the lower risk. It's a no-brainer. So We don't fund lots of projects yet. We very much cherry pick. You know, it's not like a bank where we've got to deploy money. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we selectively deploy. You know, when we see a really good project, we think, right, this is the one to go with. And you know, we are able to process more and more projects, you know, as our team grows and so on. But we're still being very, very selective. It's a huge market.
Mm. And I think just going back to something you said earlier about the kind of this sort of the 600 million sort of mass affluent, I think one thing that certainly was interesting from our point of view was around the notion of, you know, democratizing access to these, I guess, institutional grade, higher return type opportunities that are not the norm, right? We're all struggling with, you know, funds that perhaps aren't delivering what we thought they might, or we were struggling with lower interest rates. And actually this is almost like an antidote to that, but also as well, it's relatively accessible in that actually there are, you know, fewer barriers to entry. It might just be worth talking about that as well.
Absolutely. Look, I always love telling the story about my days at UBS, right? So, you know, working for an investment bank, you know, obviously had a great investment plan. And every year I remember opening the statement thinking, yes, got to have done well this year. And then you open the statement and it's abysmal every year. Good year, bad year in the markets, didn't matter. The returns were rubbish. And it really started annoying me because remember, I was in an investment bank on the sell side. So I knew a lot of the fund managers. So I knew that they were getting great bonuses. They were out buying their flashy car, you know, or whatever, their new Ferrari. So, you know, when you're on the inside, you realize how much gets soaked up in these layers of fees and inefficiencies. And, you know, there's a number of factors. You know, these big funds, because of the amount of money they've got to deploy, they can only, you know, they've got to take big positions, which has to be mainstream markets. Mainstream markets are highly efficient. So you're not going to make outsized returns there. Now, if you meanwhile are like a very wealthy individual, a family office, yeah, of course you'll have some money in stocks and bonds and, you know, all that stuff. But you'd always have an allocation to this alternative space. Now, a lot of those guys can access these kind of deals directly. Of course, they'll put money into Blackstones and so on. But for the regular investor, they could probably invest in a Blackstone fund through a platform. But the returns on there are nowhere near as good simply because, again, layers of fees, big transaction. And what we realized was actually what we're enabling is this whole disintermediation. Let's cut out the funds, all those layers, the brokers and all that stuff. Let's cut all that out. The returns we're generating, you know, people think it's eye-watering, but actually when you break it down, it's a combination. It's an inefficient market, but also you're going direct to where the money's being generated. And so by cutting out those middle layers, you're, as an investor, keeping more of the returns. And, you know, if you fast forward 10, 15, 20 years, the world is going to move in that direction. You know, individuals are going to be making their own decisions about their own portfolios, cutting out all the middlemen, because the middlemen aren't really adding any value.
One small point around the kind of accessibility of this, which I think is really interesting in terms of, you know, giving people that perhaps couldn't have accessed these kind of grade of opportunities before, you know, access to alternative investments with a low barrier to entry, right? So, you know, I can go on to Shojin's platform today, open an ISA and invest in, and start from what, £5,000 to actually 5K? Access one of your opportunities. So, you know, very, very low barrier if you kind of consider the type of a return that you're offering.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, the interesting thing with that is, you know, we take money through IFISAs. I can't remember what the recent number was, 300 billion, something like that, sitting in cash ISAs, where those cash ISAs, until recently, were generating zero. Now they're probably generating a couple of percent if you're lucky. But, you know, 300 billion in cash ISAs, where inflation is killing that off, you know, like literally it's like taking a chunk of your cash every year and just flushing it down the toilet. You know, it makes no sense. So I think, you know, what we really want to do is educate the market on the opportunities there. And by no means do you ever move all your money in. But what you should always do is have some sort of allocation to this part of the market. And depending on your age, you can take more or less of an exposure.
So I think the other thing, Jatin, that we found quite interesting when we looked at this as well was actually, you know, there have been a few failures in the kind of property kind of crowdfunding space. And actually, you guys seem to have gone to the trouble of actually not only kind of classify the degree of risk that you're taking, depending on how you invest in an opportunity, but also kind of adding layers of protection in for an investor as well, which actually is not something that we'd seen before.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's multiple things to consider here, right? You know, when a lot of people go out to invest, first of all, I could go on LinkedIn and within 10 minutes, I'd be offered something giving me a 20% return. If you ever see those, run a mile. First things first, you know, you've got to be regulated, right? At least someone's watching. It's not a guarantee of success, but at least someone's watching the firm. But as you rightly mentioned, some high profile firms did collapse. And there are various reasons for those collapses, which we can go into. But a couple of the big things that really stood out was where the area of specialism was one thing. So, you know, if you take someone like Lendi, great bridge lender in the early days, but because, you know, this is the problem with the senior lending space, because their margins were just getting squeezed, there was so much competition, they started moving into the development space. Now, development is a whole different risk profile. So, and that's what ultimately led to the collapse, because they were drip feeding money into the projects, but they had to raise the money. It all came to a head. And, you know, other firms like LCF, I mean, that's just blatant fraud, simple as that, right? You know, you can't, you know, that's something you can't protect against. I mean, the only thing you can do is just make sure you don't put all your eggs in one basket. But, you know, one thing we try and do is we try and firstly educate the investors in terms of what they're investing into. You know, a lot of people look at development as a high risk product. And on a curve, it's at the higher end, most certainly. You know, the thing to always remember is within high risk, there's high risk and then there's lower risk or controlled risk. And controlled risk comes from actually doing all the due diligence and finding what we consider to be outliers or inefficiencies. And in fact, I've used this word before. Inefficiencies are really what's driving our returns, because this market, there's not enough money in the market. You know, if you need a senior loan, like when you need a mortgage, you can go online and you can get a gazillion different rates. Appreciate they're higher now, but still lots of competition. In our market, there just isn't. So hence the returns are high because of the lack of availability of funding. Once you accept that, you know, we are in the higher risk category, but there are good projects in that high risk category because of the control, you then determine where you want to go within that. Now, as a very simple example, if you were to take a £10 million loan and slice it into four parts, the top part, the top 60% would be the senior loan, the first charge. Then you'd have the mezzanine, then you'd have the preferred equity, and then you'd have the developer's equity. And at a very simple level, let's say the top one gives you 10%, second one gives you 20%, the third one gives you 30%. And then the fourth one is the developer's equity, so he'll get a much higher return anyway. And the 10, 20, 30, by the way, is what we're getting. So let's say investors get 75% of that, to keep it simple. It's up to the investor to choose where they're comfortable. And that's really important. You know, in the old days, not necessarily on our platform, but just generally in the market, you know, people would have looked at something with, you know, 25% and said, wow, I've got to have me some of that without really considering what that means from a risk perspective. We want people to understand what that means from a risk perspective. What could cause that to drop or even disappear altogether? And, you know, when we do our due diligence, you know, and we go through, you know, over 200 elements of risk, what we're looking for are all the risk factors. We're looking for them to be mitigated. And then what you're left with is the risks you're carrying. That's what you're getting paid for. The biggest risk, obviously, being market risk, right? If the market, it doesn't even have to collapse tomorrow, right? I mean, you know, we saw how quickly things changed in the last 2 years, you know, wars breaking out, interest rate hikes, you know, political unrest in the UK. These things can move the market. And so if you're in the high return space, you're more likely to get affected if things do happen in the market. So then you might go for the lower risk position. That being said, you know, if you've got £5,000, say £10,000 to put in, you might decide, I'm going to do, actually, let's use £100,000 just to keep the number simple, but you might decide you're going to put £80,000 into the mezzanine and £20,000 into the equity. So you've got some exposure to the equity, but the bulk of it in a safer position.
So yeah, different risk profiles for kind to suit all kinds of customer needs, I guess.
And yeah,
I guess one thing that took us a while to get our head around as well, and maybe it's just worth touching on this as well, is that sometimes people think you invest in property, there's got to be a sale or a realization before you can kind of get paid back. And that actually isn't the case here if I'm investing in essentially a loan, then actually once the loan is repaid, then I am effectively repaid as well at a kind of guaranteed level of return. Just tell us a bit more how that works.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be slightly careful in that there is an exit point in each of our loans, right? So, you know, remember, we're investing into development projects. The exit can come from the sale of units or it can come from a refinancing. Right. Now, the latter is quite important because let's say someone's building 100 apartments. And we've given them money for 2 years, but the construction's only going to take 18 months. We always give them an extra 6 months for sale. As the developer's approaching that 18-month point where they think, all right, the development's going to be finished, they're going to receive what's called practical completion, which means people can start moving in. That's the point at which a developer would look and say, all right, well, out of these 100 units, I've only sold 50 so far. I've got another 6 months, so I could just wait and then just keep selling the other 50. Or I can go refinance the last 50 into what's called an exit facility. The thing about an exit facility is it's just like a normal mortgage on a whole bunch of properties, but it's much cheaper because now you've got finished properties. So it's much cheaper for them to refinance, take out the original development lender, take us out, and then have the new loan. And then as they sell the remaining units, they'll pay off the new lender. So that's a very common thing that happens nowadays because the developer doesn't want to be paying our high rates of interest for longer than they need to. And we're happy because actually getting out at 18 months, giving investors their profits early is always good. And then we move on to the next project. So that's how it works. Now, on the other side, we did have a secondary marketplace where people could sell their positions early if they needed to. Now, when somebody goes into a project, let's say it's a 2-year project, they should assume they're going to be in there for 2 years. But, you know, we all know things can happen, right? And you might suddenly, if you put 100 grand in, you might suddenly need, I don't know, 10 grand for something. Well, we had a secondary marketplace where you could list that for sale, but the FCA have decided that that does more harm to consumers than good because they think it gives them a false impression of liquidity. Mm-hmm. So I obviously have my own views and thoughts about that, which I won't share here. But the fact is, that is causing a lot of consumer harm because now it means that you can't get out early. Mm. And I don't see how that could be better for consumers. So, you know, even in an illiquid market, there's still buyers, right? You know, there's just not that many. Now you have none. So we're hoping for this decision to be changed by the FCA so we can open up the secondary marketplace.
You touched on this earlier, I think, just sort of wrapping this part up, I think. education is a real kind of cornerstone of what you're doing at Shojin. And that's one thing that I think is kind of super attractive, because not everyone is an expert in property. And it's clear from the way that, you know, just listening to you today, there's a lot of complexity here, but you guys are working hard to kind of demystify this. And there's some great resources on your website about this. And you're sort of working hard to kind of make sure people have the right level of understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, the goal is really, you know, there's a broad term called financial literacy, and this is across the board. Yeah. You know, people can graduate from a university with a first class degree in something yet not know how a mortgage works, right? I mean, our education system is failing us by not teaching money and financial skills. Now, I appreciate real estate development takes it up a notch, but the fact is it's not rocket science, and everyone should understand it before they invest in it. And what we're trying to do is just trying to raise that national, international, full-blown global understanding of investing. Because it's not, you know, unlike what the FCA might have you believe, these things are not terrible. You know, I mean, geez, you can walk into a casino and bet on red, black. You can, you know, invest in cryptocurrencies, right? This is nowhere near as bad as those things. So, and in fact, this is how a lot of wealthy people have made money, right? This is how they got to where they got to. So my view is it should be open and available for everyone. But the first thing is they've got to understand it. So, you know, get educated. And like I said, we're trying to create lots of resources on our platform for investors to understand the product before they invest.
Yeah. Awesome. So just give us your thoughts, Jackson, on the kind of your vision for the future of kind of fractional investing. You know, where does it kind of go to?
So the future is fractional. It's almost a given, right? I mean, nobody owns this space yet. I'm not saying Shojin's going to own the global market, but what we are going to do and what we have started doing is talking to people in our space all over the world to start collaborating, because everyone's got different networks of investors, but also different products, right? We are very UK-centric in the real estate product, but real estate is a global thing. So, you know, let's say you wanted to, you know, you're reading lots of good things about India. Let's say you want to invest in student accommodation in India. Well, it's really hard for you to do. Now, you could come across lots of platforms, but you may not know them. You're not sure. But let's say you're an investor with us and you trust us. If we've got a partnership with a firm in India, they're following the same kind of methodology, same risk measures, all of that as us. Well, then straight away you can say, okay, well, these guys are in the same gang. So I trust these guys in India now, and I'm going to invest. So what we're trying to do is partner with firms all around the world. And we have already started doing that. And the idea really long-term being projects all over the world, investors all over the world, and then we'll bring them all together, all the firms together, and just merge them at some point, right? Because I think the days are gone when, you know, we have to be the biggest, baddest player on the entire planet. You know, it's just not only easier, but it's probably a lot more fun just working with lots of other entrepreneurs around the world and clubbing together.
Awesome. So, Jackson, you mentioned a couple of partnerships that you've recently entered into, and I think there's one in Germany and one in Estonia. Maybe just tell us a little bit more about the opportunities that you hope will kind of come from that.
Yeah, absolutely. So a while ago, we all, you know, as I said, we've been talking to a lot of platforms for a while, and the idea is to start test driving collaboration with this German platform to begin with. You know, they're a listed platform in Germany, and they had a project in the UK. A lot of international firms come to the UK because the UK is a great market for real estate, but then they end up going back to their home market because that's the one they understand. And they had actually done some stuff in the UK. And what we did was we just joined them on that. So it's their project, but we've actually brought our investor base to it because our investor base recognize it. I mean, it's in Camden, it's up the road. So, you know, it was very easy for us to sell to our investor base, and our investor base loved that. Whereas the German investor base, they don't know what Camden is, right? So, you know, they were finding they weren't selling it as fast as we could. So, I mean, that was just an example of where we worked together with them. You know, for us, launching projects in Germany is important as well. And that we'll do through them. But again, we also know our investors like mezzanine pref equity. German investors don't. So a lot of the projects being launched out there tend to be focused in the senior space. But together, we will start doing whole loans to incorporate the whole stack. So that's a really good partnership going on in Germany. And another partner in Estonia, a firm called Reinvest24. they partnered with us to distribute some of our projects. So, you know, we're seeing such great deal flow at the moment. And as we are still growing our investor base, you know, when we're talking to these other platforms, and if they're saying, look, in their markets, they're not seeing great projects at the moment, they're just holding fire, but their investors are still keen to do something, they can show them our product and therefore cross-pollinate investors. In exactly the same way, you know, we're talking to other firms across Europe, in Asia as well, in India, Singapore, Hong Kong, Middle East, so Dubai, Saudi. So there'll be a lot more of those partnerships coming.
Awesome. We'll keep an eye out for those on your website. Let's move on to the recent branding exercise, Jatin, that we went through together. So tell us a bit about the drivers behind the project from your perspective. What were you trying to achieve?
Our previous branding was put together probably around 2015, 2016. It was very old school, like a JP Morgan style, you know, dark blue cards, all that kind of stuff. And what we found was that it was just inconsistent with who we are today, the way we work with our investors, you know, the website, you know, all of these things. There was a lot of inconsistency across everything. So really that's what drove us to have this discussion around rebranding. And it was really, the intention was really to align the branding with our vision, but also our values and, you know, what our purpose is, if you like, as a business. Really, really tough thing to do, but great result at the end.
Well, thank you. Good to hear that. And I guess, you know, just reflecting on what you've just said, where you were, I guess, was a function of how the business started with your background in banking. And I guess your first clients or your first investors were from that world, right? But I think that, you know, the vision is big. And maybe it's worth just talking about that in terms of, you know, democratizing access to this space and kind of, you know, engaging these kind of 600 million mass affluent people and to kind of reach them, you've got to be kind of engaging them in a way that's going to feel relevant to them, I guess.
Money's still a very personal thing, right? You know, even at 5K, it's not a small amount of money. But, you know, most of, I think our average investment size into each project is around 25 to 30K. So it needs to, you know, it needs to be professional. It needs to have that look and feel that, you know, we're a trusted firm. But at the same time, you know, I recognize, and again, this is where the difficulties come in. Our core investor base was probably age 35 to 55. But, you know, increasingly, you know, it was moving downwards as well because, you know, obviously young people grow up, they start earning money and, you know, we need to attract them as well. And if you think about the business, our vision is really, it's to fully democratize investment into real estate and enable everyone to invest in due course, you know, even at 50 quid, we're not there yet. But, you know, given that that's our vision, where we want to go and, you know, from a purpose perspective, it really is all about spreading wealth, right? You know, the biggest problem we have today is that wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few. There's no reason that shouldn't be spread out. It's just that the others, they don't go and grab it for themselves, right? Because they don't even know it exists. So it's all about changing all of that. It's making people realize that wealth is there for everyone. But what's happened is we've all been conditioned to not reach for it. So you think, well, that kind of wealth belongs to those kind of people, not to our kind of people. So what we were trying to do with this was trying to present it in a way which made it much more open and inviting and accessible. And you know, our previous branding, you know, with the dark, the navy blue and the slightly kind of gold embossed, you know, you can just imagine it at a private members club, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas actually this, we don't, you know, that's not actually our goal. Our goal is to be a Starbucks, if you like. You know, the premium coffee doesn't have to just be for the few at the top. It's for everyone. So, and that's what we've tried to create here. And even, you know, the tagline, you know, next level investing, it's really just trying to get people to think about, you know, there is another level to get to. You know, people shouldn't stay in the bog standard investment products.
100%. And so, I mean, just going back slightly, what were your kind of expectations? Because obviously the output is not tangible right at the start in that, you know, you don't quite know where you're going to migrate to. So just be kind of good to get your sense of what that felt like and what you kind of expected from from the process?
I think I was a real pain in the process a lot of the time, because I'd almost think through things to the nth degree. But, you know, in reality, it's just, how does it make one feel? You know, when someone goes on there, does it look cheap? Does it look expensive? Does it look like a firm that knows what they're doing? Or does it look like a firm that's just trying to, you know, sell a whole load of kind of crap, you know? So it's really, really difficult. And what I found going through the process was, you know, looking at every iteration, every, you know, logo, the font, the colors, that, you know, all these things, you know, my thing would be to end up nitpicking on a lot of things, because it's almost, I know our product inside out and I know how I want someone to feel, because in theory, I'm a typical client, or I was a typical client. As a client, what would I expect to see? Now, I can only talk from the perspective of someone my age, and I'm almost 50. So that's my mentality. And what was good was having other guys in the room, like from our marketing team, who are much younger and can look at it from that perspective as well, because we're trying to do a lot in one place. And so, you know, I think my expectation really was, I was trusting was the process whereby if we discuss and debate each of the components, when the components do come together, it will be something that I'm like, yeah, I'm happy with that, you know. And I think it's done that quite well. And we've been getting a lot of very good feedback as well on the overall branding. But I think from the outset, my only expectation was that by the time we finish, it should be something I'm proud of. You know, it should be something I'm proud to say to people, all right, this is our website. Because, you know, ultimately as CEO, you know, it's an extension of you. So yeah, that was kind of what was going through my mind.
Any key learnings from the process that you'd like to share with others maybe thinking on, you know, embarking on something similar?
Make sure you've got time to devote to it. I think, and I'm sure you noticed this as well, you know, I think I was rushing around like a headless chicken most of the time. So I think when I would obviously still make time to get engaged, but I almost didn't have time to appreciate things enough before just pouncing on it and say, I like this and I don't like this, without fully understanding it. I think, look, if you're going to embark on something like this, it's a big project, right? So give it the time and attention it needs, because you're going to have it for several years. So if you're going to do it, give it the right attention.
I think as you know, to your point, you know, this is something that you obviously want to get a return on the investment, right? You're going to need to live with it for a period of time, and getting the job done is one thing, but then actually, you know, actually enabling it and activating it over a period of time is a completely different thing. And actually, that's kind of one of the reasons, I guess, why we spent a lot of time obsessing over the details, because to your point, it's how does it make you feel? And actually, if I am, you know, working in the back end of Shojin's platform, for example, then actually that needs to live up to the brand promise as well, in terms of, you know, accessibility, the experience that it kind of conveys. It's important that all of these kind of touch points are lined up. So actually kind of doing the work and kind of launching it is just the start. You know, there's still work to be done.
Yeah. Look, I think definitely. And I think it goes so much further. It's everything, right? And, you know, this is a challenge for a lot of businesses way bigger than us, but it's making sure that everyone in the firm is living the values, you know, is thinking about things in the same approach. And if you take a really simple example, even down to how we dress, you know, if we all came to work in pinstripe suits every day, that really wouldn't correlate with what you're seeing on the website. Thankfully, we don't come in pinstripe suits, as you can see. It's the psyche that needs to go all the way across. You know, rebranding is actually, I think it's just the starting point of something that then has to filter through the whole organization in terms of the way you are, the way you behave and everything. Yeah. And I think a lot of people probably don't actually understand that initially.
I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. You've got to kind of make sure that's embodied in everything that you do. And, you know, I know that you spend a lot of time developing content, right? And that's an ongoing thing, to actually help people with understanding, you know, each investment comes with a pretty detailed prospectus and outlining the risks, opportunities. Maybe it's just worth touching on that, because you guys go to a lot of trouble over those documents as well.
When someone comes onto our platform, they you know, the starting point is they shouldn't feel intimidated, right? You know, this is outside of most people's comfort zone. And so what we want to do is make it as engaging as possible and educate as much as possible. You'll notice there's no real hard sell, hard push on the website and throughout the process. And there's a reason for that. It's because we've seen over the years, people will join, people will register, they'll sit on the sidelines, come, you know, attend webinars, read our materials that go out, read the blogs, all of that stuff. When they're ready, they come in and start doing something. And that's the thing, you know, it's you've got to give it the time to kind of go through its own process and, you know, to get people ready. I think if you start, you know, either with a lot of hard sell or if they feel intimidated, you know, straight away, then they're not going to move forward. So even the IMs or the investment memorandum when we're launching a project, they're written in a way which has all the information, but without jargon, you know, very simplified, very clear cut. And then on top of that, we always make ourselves available because especially with the first investment, people might want to just talk to someone, and that's absolutely fine.
Well, I think the fact that you actually do it is great, and you know that you're taking the trouble and time to answer the question is brilliant. And I think what it actually is a great example of brand and behavior kind of lining up, right? You guys are walking the talk, and that's kind of from our point of view is really great to see because you've got to do both of those things for it to work. And you know, good to hear you recognize that and talk about it as well. Just to sort of wrap up, Jatin, is there anything you can tell us about the impact of the work so far? Like anything tangible you can point to or intangible maybe, like, you know, anecdotal?
I think a couple of things. And remember, with the rebranding, the whole front end of the website was redesigned as well. And that was really crucial because what we had before was we didn't have control over the front end and it was very clunky. Whereas now that we have that greater control, the workflow is better. And I think the way you built it and designed it is just a much more modern looking website. And the navigation is much more simpler. So what we're finding is now, whether it's a regular investor coming on there or a family office coming on there, it doesn't look to one like it belongs to the other. Before, there was a danger, you know, on the one hand, it was designed like a family office style. But then on the front page, it was like, you know, invest from 5,000. And then a lot of the stuff that was there made it feel very retail. Whereas now, actually, whether it's a retail investor or a family office investor, there's a workflow for them, which keeps them engaged, you know, and it kind of addresses what they want. So in that I've already seen make a big difference. And apart from that, the other thing is, I mean, I've just had general comments from a lot of people saying they really like the redesign and the general usability as well.
Awesome. Great to hear. Thank you very much. So just to wrap us up then, Jatin, for anyone else out there that's thinking about, you know, rebranding or doing a similar thing to what we did together, any advice that you would give them?
Earlier I mentioned just make sure you give it the time that it needs. I think when you are considering rebranding, just don't consider it as an isolated, you're not just changing a logo, right? Rebranding is something that needs to weave through the entire organization. So just really think about what you're trying to do, why you're looking to rebrand, what you want to achieve. And it's probably worth sitting down with you guys actually, because I know you guys kind of asked a lot of very, very good questions, which kind of drew a lot of this out. So I think, if anyone's thinking of rebranding, just consider what they're looking to achieve and understand what that means from the beginning for the organization as a whole and who should be involved in that process as well. Because the other thing is you want to take your team on the same journey. What you don't want to do is just come in one day and say, right, guys, this is our new branding. Actually, we had a lot of input from our team, which was great. So by the time it came out, everyone was bought into it.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's great advice. I think, you know, there should always be a strategic rationale behind a rebrand. You know, the logo and the color are the last things that you should be thinking about. And actually, your second point about team alignment is so critical because it can't be a case of someone went off for 6 months, did something, and then kind of does a big reveal and people are like, well, okay, great. Where did that come from? You've got to bring people along with you, right? So they understand it. And actually, they can kind of get behind it. And to the point we discussed earlier, they can, you know, the behaviors that we need that are driven by the values will be adopted. So yeah, super advice. So, Jatin, thank you so much for joining us today. And look forward to seeing what Shojin does in the future.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for having me on here. And thank you so much for all the great work on the branding.
Great partnership. Thank you very much, Jatin.
Cheers, guys. See ya.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join us next time on The B Word. Please note, the information on this podcast is not intended as financial advice.